This is a download from the Post Keynesian Economics Study Group, PKSG. For more information and terms of use, please visit www.postkeynesian.net.
On the 14th of February 2012, our main speaker was the author, journalist and broadcaster Nicholas Wapshot, who spoke on the theme of his new book, Keynes-Hayek, The Clash That Defined Modern Economics, with a response from Professor Andrew Gamble of the University of Cambridge. Enjoy listening.
It's wonderful to be here in Cambridge. As so much as you can imagine, an author, here I am sitting in a garret in New York trying to imagine what Cambridge was like in the early 30s. So I've mentally been living in Cambridge for a little while. I spoke to the students of the LSE last night, and the other half of my brain was spending a lot of time in Houghton Street in the early 30s. But this is a story, I hope you'll excuse if I describe it as a story, which is extraordinary in as much as it's rare to come across a paradigm shift in any discipline which is so eagerly awaited but at the same time so vehemently resisted. What was happening with Keynes, who was the disciple, of course, of Marshall, the great economics guru, who really did the spade work in terms of laying down the vocabulary and the grammar of what might today be called Anglo-Saxon economics. It was Marshall who persuaded Keynes that he was too good a mathematician to waste it on maths and instead should become an economist. And so Marshall's encouragement actually led to what was to be his own replacement, that is, the next great wave of economic thought, which came out of John Maynard Keynes's capacious intellect. What I'm about to tell you is actually how, seeing how Keynes, through the 20s in particular, was working out his theories more or less in public. He was an extraordinary, prodigious writer and journalist, actually, who was able to write for the London Times, not a bit like tabloid it is today, but a rather austere and well-mannered and grown-up newspaper in those days, intended for the top people. But he also was able to write for the Daily Mail, which I must say is much the same then as now. A pretty good scandal sheet. But he was able to have this enormous range. And this caught the attention of William Beveridge, who was the director of the London School of Economics, and in particular Lionel Robbins, who boasted endlessly, it should be said, that he was the youngest economics professor in Britain. In 1927, he was aged 30, and he was given the chair at the LSE, and he, through personal ambition and an institutional ambition, was determined to counter what he saw as likely to be a Keynesian revolution going on in front of his nose. So Robbins was an interesting man. He's the person, actually, later on in life, in the 60s, who was commissioned to do a report which recommended that tertiary education be expanded very fast in Britain if Britain was to keep up. So all of the new universities of the 60s, York, Lancaster, Keele, Warwick, Essex, Sussex, Kent, and so on, all stem out of Lionel Robbins. But in the late 20s, he was focused on a rather different thing. He was that unusual person, even today, that is an Englishman who was entirely fluent in German. And he'd read a lot of Austrian economics, and he thought that that was the way forward, and that was the way actually to counter whatever Keynes was dreaming up. Keynes had been appalled, not only, as you may remember, by World War I, when he resigned from the Treasury in protest at the Paris peace talks because of the scale of reparations to be imposed upon the losing countries of Germany and Austria-Hungary. And he came home and wrote The Economic Consequences of the Peace, in which he argued that if you deliberately beggar a sophisticated modern industrial nation as Germany was then, you would encourage extreme politics, extreme solutions, extreme leaders, and may well lead towards a Second World War not before long. Of course, he was miserably proved right on that. He was offended, though, because the British government, in its unwisdom, had decided to keep the parity of the pound sterling in 1918 the same as it had been in 1914. And that meant that actually there was large-scale, persistent unemployment in Britain for the decade before the Great Depression, as before you add on top what then was to happen in the Great Depression. This offended Keynes. Keynes was a very privileged young man. His father was a don at Cambridge, and he was educated at Eton and then at King's, and he was blessed by that sense of noblesse oblige that such a young gentleman might naturally expect to have. He was therefore spent his whole time through the 20s suggesting various ways of trying to improve the lot of the unemployed, including the suggestion that the government, as the spender of last resort, should spend in order to try to get people back to work. He had no particular theoretical basis for these sorts of suggestions. There have been a number of economists who made very similar sorts of suggestions in the past. But he was a very pragmatic fellow. He was very political. And he had the ear of every chancellor and prime minister between the wars, in fact, until his death in 1946. And he pressed upon them. He waged two campaigns, one in public and one privately in Whitehall, trying to get people to adopt what later became known as the sort of mainstay of Keynesian political solutions, economic policies. Robbins chose that he really wanted someone who could bring down Keynes and was an articulate purveyor of the Austrian school of thought, of economic thought. The obvious person, actually, was a man called Ludwig von Mises, a rather cantankerous fellow, not very good English at all, if any, and he was the leader of the Austrian school, but he was, for one reason or another, unprepared to move. He actually had a perfectly good job in Vienna, and really didn't need anything like that. But Hayek was a very different thing. Hayek had been inspired by Keynes, returning from, of course, the other side of the military fence, as it were. He returned from the Italian front to his home in Vienna in order to discover the Austro-Hungarian Empire, this grand item in the politics of Europe for so long, had become, Austria had become sort of decapitated head of an empire that was no more. Hungary had gone, all of the colonies had gone, and the usual things that a capital might expect in terms of the provision of food, goods, commodities, and so on, were no longer being sent loyally to the capital of the empire. He found that his parents were shivering, sat shivering with their overcoats on in their apartments in Vienna because they couldn't afford to buy fuel. There was also rampant inflation going on. He had begun to study economics and had fallen under the spell of von Mises. He started off, by the way, as a socialist, which is interesting and paradoxical. And it was at that time, therefore, that he was interested in Keynes's explanation in The Economic Consequences of the Peace of what was about to happen to the rest of Europe. He was obviously in favour of Keynes in those days. He was rather encouraged by Keynes, having spotted that actually there were a number of different treaties. Germany had one treaty and Austria had another and so on and, among the Allies there. And the Austrian one was very sympathetic and in The Economic Consequences of the Peace. He had spelled out exactly what Hayek was feeling. What Keynes was predicting, Hayek was enduring, and that was terrible depredations, a crumbling of civilization, a disruption of the economic order, and the prospect of anarchy or worse. He therefore made it his business to get hold of Keynes, to stalk Keynes, if you like. It is, I think it's probably not too strong a thing to say. He actually set out to draw Keynes' attention to him, Keynes being immensely famous by this stage in the mid-20s. Famous on both sides of the Atlantic, by the way. The Economic Consequences of the Peace was very well read in America, not least the way that he dismissed Woodrow Wilson for being a wretched man who, with full of good intentions, had actually presided over a disaster at the Paris peace talks. Hayek sent him a note asking for a copy of a book, which Keynes, in fact, didn't have, and sent back a note to him. It's very telling that Keynes, who kept every laundry bill, every restaurant receipt, every small item of his personal behavior, because he was aware that actually he was a great man, has no record of anything coming from Hayek. But we do know that he responded to Hayek because there's a postcard now, a proud possession of that great cathedral of the right, the Hoover Institution. It was a well-presented postcard saying, "Dear Hayek, haven't got the book, yours ever, Keynes." That was just the beginning. The following year, 1928, Hayek engineered a meeting in London of one of those joint economic associations, which some of you may belong to already, and he made it his business to go up to Keynes, introduce him, and then start off having a row with him. This was a great argument. It was, again, very memorable to Hayek, who recorded every jot and tittle of it, but it was not important at all to Keynes, who barely noticed it. When Lionel Robbins sent out to get Hayek to come to work in London on his behalf, therefore, Hayek was absolutely ready. He was to give four lectures at the LSE, which would act as a sort of audition for the job. Beveridge was already set up in advance. And he arrived, but instead of going to the LSE, he actually came straight to Cambridge. And it must have been a wonderful sight, actually. He came to address the Marshall Society, and it was a small group of people, including most of the young Keynesian acolytes of the time, Joan Robinson, Richard Kahn, all of these people who would become great figures in the Keynesian Revolution. And he tried to explain to them the essence of Austrian economics. And he drew on the blackboard a succession of triangles where he pointed out that if you were to either, as Keynes was suggesting, alter the interest rates, make it a bit cheaper, or if you were to do anything else in order to manipulate the market to produce more jobs, you would probably end up with more unemployed eventually than ever before. It was almost the beginning of the attack on what a Keynesian stimulus was to become. The Marshall Society, rather like Keynes himself, has a very waspish reputation and used to very enjoy poking fun of the people who came to speak to them. But in this case, they were all absolutely dumbfounded. Both Joan Robinson and Richard Kahn leave very colourful reports of it. Richard Kahn was smart enough to try to break the ice when Hayek said in his broken English, a bit like me, by the way, he had a cold, so one may excuse him for his IQ being down about 15 points. But anyway, he said, any questions? There was nothing. So Richard Kahn eventually broke the silence by saying, "Am I right in thinking, Professor Hayek, that if I were tomorrow to go out and buy an overcoat, that would actually contribute to unemployment?" To which Hayek said, "Yes, it would, but it would take me a very long time to explain exactly why." Anyway, it was a very brave thing to walk into the lion's den like that. Robbins, of course, was appalled when he heard the account of what had happened to Hayek, and ensured by packing the hall at the LSE and giving people a little tutorial ahead of time so that they understood exactly what they were about to be told by Hayek, this packed hall greeted him as a hero, and he was duly appointed. The first task that Robbins gave him was to review in Economica the most recent Keynes tome, which was a treatise on money. Well, if you've read a treatise on money, it's a very interesting work, actually. But in the preface to it, Keynes explains that actually this is just a work in progress. Not to take any of this too seriously, but he'd spent too much time fiddling around with his stuff. It was all very interesting, but he got past that stage. But for what it's worth, here it was, and out it came. Hayek, however, took it absolutely as if it was gospel, and in the Economica assaulted it in the most bitter, ad hominem, vile, sarcastic terms that you're likely to see in any learned journal. It's quite unlikely to have a duel by learned journal, but that's exactly what then took place. Keynes, one of his great qualities, Keynes, was that he could never quite resist a scrap when offered to him. He's like one of those people who go into a bar, and if they hear a scuffle going on the corner, they say, "I'm just going to go and find out what that's about," and then you find they're taking part. Keynes loved a fight, and so he pinged off, again, a waspish, rude, personalised assault upon Hayek, and so it went. Every edition of Economica thereafter, the next few, had Hayek followed by Keynes, reposting to the previous one, followed by Hayek's next one, and so on. Anyway, that developed then into a very interesting personal correspondence between the two of them. They were writing two letters a day to each other throughout the whole of the autumn of 1931. Even on Christmas Day 1931, they sat down and wrote two letters to each other. It says something about the way the post office, of course, operated in 1931. I don't think you tried to post a letter on Christmas Day today, but that's what happened. And in the end, Keynes just got a bit bored with it. He thought that maybe there was something in it, but he couldn't really be bothered anymore. He had something to do, which, of course, was the work towards the general theory. And so he gave up, exasperated. And if you look back at the dispute, it's very interesting. It's largely unfathomable. They didn't get past first base. They were arguing about terms right to the end, saying, I don't know what you mean by investment, what do you mean by replacement investment, and so on. So they never actually laid a glove on each other. But it certainly drew attention, first of all, which I guess Lionel Robbins wanted, to the LSE and to Hayek himself. Keynes handed off a bit of dirty work to Piero Straffer, who was a real fighter, so that the debate continued in Economica for a little longer. But otherwise, actually, that is the beginning and end of the economic battle between Keynes and Hayek. And I would say, actually, that the economics of Hayek really didn't amount to very much. And even today, Austrian economics is a very narrow field, and very few people take it very seriously. Even the whole of the United States, which goes in for rather wacky theories quite often, there's only one department of Austrian economics in the whole of the United States, at George Mason University, which, interestingly, if you visit there from Washington, D.C., you get off at a subway station called Vienna, which is rather nice. But, of course, the rest of the story of Keynes you'll be familiar with. Keynes worked along with his members of the Cambridge Circus, Kahn, Robinson, the two Robinsons and so on, all of the other members, to refine what he'd put forward as a policy presentation, but in the end wanted to put together as a formal and coherent theory. Richard Kahn, of course, famously helped him prove that his notion about the multiplier, that if you spend £1, it's not worth just £1, because the pound will be spent and given to someone else who will then spend it again and so on. So every pound was worth much more than that. So every pound invested, as it were, or spent by the government was worth far more than that. And strangely, or maybe not strangely in terms of Keynes, Keynes got the figure almost exactly right when Kahn worked out the arithmetic. The general theory turned out to be, as you know, absolutely the gear shift change. It was really, there are other people involved in the invention of macroeconomics, but if there's one person who brought all of economics together in a new way, looked at it as a whole system, almost like a single equation, so that if you changed one variable, it would alter something else. That was entirely Keynes's doing. He was anxious because the 1930s, of course, were even more terrible for unemployment, both in Britain and then particularly in the United States, than even in the 20s. So he was anxious that his opinions should be turned into policy fast. But he found that his personal charm, which was astonishing. Even Hayek admitted that the gaze of his dark eyes could hypnotize people. Also, by the way, Kenneth Clark said of Maynard Keynes, he was a man who could never dip his headlights. He was extraordinary in terms of his intellect. What happened at the end of the general theory is familiar, I'm sure. Keynes was always very anxious that there would be no circumstances in which the craven politicians would ever dare borrow enough money to test out whether his theory worked, unless, of course, it was in the event of war. And actually, the war that he predicted and the economic consequences of the peace came around rather faster than he imagined. And it did indeed, or it seemed to, prove that Keynes was absolutely right. That is, the United States, Britain, and France borrowed very heavily, notwithstanding what they were trying to do domestically. They knew that they were about to face an existential threat, and the cost of the rearmament not only employed absolutely everybody by 1940, but actually more than 100%, in as much as great numbers of people who had never worked before, housewives, other people, were drawn into the labour market, which more than convinced people in general, and politicians in particular, that Keynesianism worked. So come 1945, then, we were ready for the Keynesian Revolution. Keynes died in 1946 and never saw the fruit of his labors. And he was rather anxious, about the fact that if you reduced spending, that there might be a trough directly after the war ended. That was not to happen. Now, Hayek had been largely ignored during the late 30s. And this is one of those questions you wonder. There are some things that happen in life, in history. What if something else had happened? What if, for instance, Friedrich Hayek had been accepted by MI6, who he volunteered for? He said, I speak fluent German, I'm an anti-Nazi, I've got a lot of things to say, I could broadcast, I could write speeches for people, I could write scripts and so on for the BBC to broadcast. I'm a useful person. He was recommended by all sorts of good and great people, including the Director General of the BBC, but he wasn't accepted. He was told, no, thank you very much, we don't need you. And so he was left sort of kicking his heels in Hampstead Garden suburb and set about writing The Road to Serfdom, the book, which has got nothing to do with economics, really, but it was actually turned out to be a second front against Keynesianism in practice, I suppose, a political solution. And The Road to Serfdom actually is a fascinating book. It's amazingly slim. It's very easy to read. Most of the people who in America today describe themselves as Hayekians plainly have never read it because it contains all sorts of little nuggets which shows that Hayek did not believe he wasn't a pure laissez-faire merchant. He had a much more complex understanding of things than that. But his simple truth from The Road to Serfdom was this. He looked up to the Soviet Union and he looked at Nazi Germany and he said these are not at opposite ends of the political spectrum, they are exactly the same thing. These are authoritarian regimes who purge the market from within human discourse. And by taking away the ability of people to trade with each other, to buy and sell, you are actually removing individual liberties. He was never entirely strident about the link between the two. He just suggested that the larger the state sector would be, the more it would be likely that personal liberties would be trammelled. And that is, of course, the germ of that is, of course, which has made Friedrich Hayek the great hero of the right today in America, where every single Republican candidate mouths the short form of Hayek, which is to say, we need to reduce the federal government fast, we need to pay off the deficit, and we need sound money. We don't need the Federal Reserve to print money anymore, all of which comes out of Hayek. Hayek did another thing, which also countered Keynes. Obviously, if you're going to reduce the size of any government, that is, if you say the government, the state should be minimal and the rest should be looked after by private industry, although Hayek said that the market should be regulated properly so that it was a true market, it wasn't just laissez-faire, it wasn't devil take the hindmost, you actually needed some structure within which the market would work. That, of course, attacked the effect of Keynesianism, because as part of Keynes's prescription, as portrayed in the general theory, there were three ways that, like, first of all, he linked two things together. That is that he thought that unemployment was caused by a lack of aggregate demand. And in his coherent understanding of the way that the whole of an economy might work, he worked out that if you increased demand, you would reduce unemployment. And he said there were three easy ways of doing this. One was to reduce interest rates for as long as possible so that people could predictably borrow money cheaply and use it to invest in things, to buy things, and so on. You should reduce taxation because that puts money back in people's pockets. Again, this is an idea which is generally considered to be an idea of the right, but in fact it's a Keynesian notion, and it's not a Hayekian notion. Hayek believed, rather oddly, that you should only reduce taxes if you had a budget surplus, which of course is completely contrary to most conservative thinkers today. But his notion was that if Keynesianism was to do with, by the way, there was a corollary to trying to even out the bottom of the business cycle, and that was that when everybody was back to work and everybody was prosperous, in order to prevent the inflation that you would get by having too much money in the system chasing too few goods, you should pay off the debt at the top of the business cycle, something which, as you'll discover, no politician is ever quite able to do. The second thing that Hayek did, of importance, was that he came to the conclusion that the thing that inspired the left was the notion of a utopia. The fact was that communism and socialism and generally people on the left had a very clear notion in their minds about where they were heading. They may never reach the Holy Grail. They may never reach the Elysian fields of communism, true communism or true socialism, but they were inspired by a better tomorrow, if only various things were brought into being. And Hayek, therefore, called together literally a summit, inasmuch as it was held in a hotel on a mountaintop in Switzerland. It was a skiing hotel, but he did it in the summer. And he invited every maverick, contrarian, conservative, libertarian that he could, brought together about 40 people. And he introduced himself to them and said what he was looking for was effectively a conservative or libertarian or at least a right-wing version of the left's utopia. He needed a right utopia. He said that's the thing that's going to inspire people. The fact that there can be a time, however impractical, when our ideas have full sway. And the Mont Pelerin Society met every year for way more than 30 years. It still exists in a rather ramshackle form today, even. Hayek warned at that very first meeting, he said it might take a lot of time. There's a head of steam behind Keynesianism. And it may even take 30 years before they discover that what they're doing is wrong. But we should be ready. And we should also be ready with an alternative reality, an alternative utopia. And if you look, if you've been watching this extraordinary reality show that the Republican Party race has become, you will notice Ron Paul, the purest of the Austrians. He actually even said once, I hope we can get rid of Keynes and then we can look forward to Austria, which I must say, for those with a sense of history, was rather chilling. At the moment, Ron Paul is taking about 1 in 5 of Republican registered Republicans, and which is a lot of voters. And they're also mostly young. And they are inspired by a vision. There's no doubt that there is a Hayekian notion which seems to drive them. I guess they've read The Road to Serfdom, but they probably didn't read Keynes's riposte. Hayek, in order to get a little free publicity, had sent to Keynes an early copy of The Road to Serfdom. And Keynes read it when he and Lydia were on their way to the Bretton Woods Agreement. What was to become the Bretton Woods Agreement? Of course, as you know, Keynes invented almost all of the modern institutions, international institutions of finance. Some, like the Bretton Woods Agreements, have gone into abeyance. But the IMF and the World Bank were both inventions of his, too. On the boat, he read the book. It didn't take him very long. And then he wrote a letter, a charming letter to Hayek, saying, Dear Friedrich, I so enjoy the book. I'm so glad you raised these points. It's very important. Absolutely. Tyranny is just around the corner, if it only goes a little wrong. However, I noticed you mentioned, in passing, that part of the perfect society in which your market can operate is that, as it is to be a civilized society, you should have universal health care, that you should, you're also recommending there should be provision of a roof over everybody's head, and there should be a generous safety net, a social safety net. So he said, far from being the absolutist that you suggest, Friedrich, surely we're talking purely about where you draw the line about where the state is, and you're drawing it in a slightly different place from where I would draw it. In fact, I think there should be more planning, not less. And that was his riposte. Hayek, by the way, tried, set out to contradict Keynes's general theory. When it came to it, Lionel Robbins chose not Hayek, maybe didn't like the way that the original dispute had gone. Instead, he chose Arthur Pigou, the Cambridge professor of economics, who himself had fallen out of favor with Keynes in one way or another, who wrote a pretty good riposte. But it wasn't the devastating halting of Keynesianism, which Lionel Robbins had hoped. And in fact, Hayek, through all his years, never quite got round to writing that definitive rebuttal of the general theory, though he made about 5 different attempts to excuse himself, none of which are particularly plausible. The fact is that he just, I think, couldn't confront it. He was writing a big book of his own. He got stuck in it. He actually got bored with his own work, and he thought that maybe it was going to be far too difficult to rebut every last thing, not least because there was such a head of steam behind Keynes. Well, to cut a long story short, by the mid-70s, there was a change in public policy because the business cycle and the electoral cycle got out of sync, and there was no well, very few presidents or prime ministers, strangely Eisenhower was one of them, who were capable, when they saw their party losing the next election, not putting their foot firmly on the gas ahead of time, so that there would be a little boomlet which would see them over the awkwardness of the general election. Eisenhower did indeed pay off the borrowing that he had taken out in order to, on infrastructure projects. He spent it all on interstate highways in America, very important and very useful for commercial business. On the other hand, in order to get it past the right, he suggested the interstate highways were essential for defense against communism. That's the sort of handstands that you have to do if you're a president of the United States. And anyway, he paid off his debt, which meant that his successor as a Republican candidate at the 1960 election was Richard M. Nixon. If you remember the result of the 1960 election, it was actually Nixon got more votes than Kennedy. It was rather like Gore Bush, but in fact, he lost the election. Everybody says that it was Joe Kennedy, John Kennedy's father, who'd bought so many votes in Illinois that that's the thing that it tipped it over the edge. But anyway, Richard Nixon spent the whole time after that complaining about Eisenhower, who of course was his father-in-law, saying that if only he'd been a little less fiscally correct and a little more politically advantageous, then he would have got into the White House in 1960, which is a very interesting thought. By 1975, there had reached that stage where there was stagflation, combination of rampant inflation and no economic growth. Stepped forward one of the people who had been at the original Mont Pelerin meeting and continued thereafter, very influential, the Chicago economist Milton Friedman. He, as it turns out, and in retrospect even more so, was actually a Keynesian. He was one of the many people who, when Hayek tried to get a job at the Economics Department of Chicago, which was known for its dryness of thought, its fiscal solidity, he said, no, thank you very much. First of all, we don't think much of your economics. And if we wanted a new economist from the Austrian school, you wouldn't be the one. So I'm afraid that Hayek never, he had to go into the social studies department in Chicago, which was where he spent most of the rest of his days. Friedman suggested briefly that, hugely controversial at the time, looking back on it, it's not so drastic, that in order to prevent the inflation that goes with the sort of vast government spending, what you should do is just increase the supply of money gradually and predictably so that there indeed would be inflation, but it would be predictable and on a small scale. And that's about all he said. One of the many things against Milton Friedman, of course, that people misunderstood his ideas, particularly in Britain, where Geoffrey Howe, who I don't think knows anything about it, well, probably knows a little bit about economics, but he was the person who introduced the 1981 famous Milton Friedman monetarist budget, and it went terribly wrong. They already in dire straits, the economy was driven into recession, and actually it took, this is a little postscript, it took another Austrian, a man called Jörg Niehans, who was... this is typical of Mrs. Thatcher, so that it wouldn't get into the public realm. The Center for Policy Studies hired Professor Niehans to come and look at the books, and he says, you've totally misunderstood this. This is not how it should go. You need to do this, that, and the other. And it was fixed at the subsequent budget and went ahead. Now, let's fast forward to more recent events. 2008-2009, we found ourselves, first of all, a stock market crash, followed by a financial mayhem as one financial institution after another looked over the brink of bankruptcy. And it was a crossroads, I guess. The President of the United States in particular, but it happened here too, under Gordon Brown, had a choice. You either intervene, you either halt the bankruptcies that were about to take place, or you let the market find its own level. Well, it didn't take them very long, either of them, to work out that to let the market find its own level could be absolutely catastrophic. All savings might well have disappeared. All of the banks, maybe, apart from one or two, would have gone. It's very interesting to know what Friedrich Hayek might have thought of that, actually, because he was much more interested in a lively, competitive market than he was against the his other hand, which was to say you shouldn't intervene. So where Hayek may have stood on that, I'm not quite sure, but it's very interesting. Anyway, it was Keynes that Brown and Obama grabbed for, and Keynes enjoyed a very brief but interesting resurgence. In pure old-fashioned Keynesian terms, there was to be, indeed there was, a $1 trillion, huge amount of money, stimulus. Now, we can talk about whether the stimulus was well spent. I mean, I always say when people ask me about was it well spent, you know, if you and I had $1 trillion to spend by next Wednesday, we'd make some pretty awful spending decisions, you know. It's a bit like being a lottery winner or something, you know, you end up doing silly things. Keynesian terms, I suppose it really doesn't matter as long as the money gets into the economy. But the fact is it's very difficult to get things like shovel-ready projects, just ordered up. I think the Hoover Dam took 7 years to plan and 5 years to build. I mean, big public sector projects are complicated. So, yes, so some money was wasted. And a lot of money actually didn't go into spending at all. Well, it did in a roundabout way. It was given to states and cities to prevent them firing workers. And it got them through enough so that actually they never had to fire workers. So it didn't create jobs, but it prevented more unemployment. And last year, and now in this year, as we come into the general election in the United States, again, Obama is asking for another $500 billion stimulus. He calls it a jobs bill, but if you actually look at it, it is a straightforward, old-fashioned Keynesian stimulus, just pumping money into the economy quick. Of course, he's prevented from doing that by the rise of the Hayekians. It's most peculiar the way that this fellow who was just a footnote. I mean, if you read Robert Sigdelsky's excellent three-volume Life of Keynes, or indeed Roy Harrod's most interesting account of Keynes, the very first official biography, Hayek's just a footnote. And I think a lot of people, I must say, in my private thoughts, me too, would think and that's where he should be, actually. However, the fact is that this fellow with a single truth, with enormous persistence, with extraordinary certainty, with the ability just to stand outside the crowd without being drawn in to the general current. He often said, you know, it would have been so much easier if I'd become a socialist like everyone else. You know, I would have been preferred, I would have had much more pay, I would have many more friends, I'd have much nicer life, but that was not to be. The fact that the Hayekian ideas are now dominating the American right is most extraordinary, which is why, looking back at the battle between Keynes and Hayek, I found it fascinating just to see exactly what had gone on and whether indeed Hayek had scored any points in his economic debates. I guess not very many at all. But at the same time, it was a tale of the tortoise and the hare. The fact is that as glamorous and as elegant and as articulate and persuasive as John Maynard Keynes was, the fact was that the tortoise, by steadily going on, not least because I suppose he outlived him, has become one of the most significant and important thinkers to guide the intellectual right. I mean, I was joking before we came here when we were having a cup of tea, that when I grew up, it was an oxymoron to think of as a conservative intellectual. But now that's not the case, and it's based upon the ideas of people like Hayek. Now, there are other ways to tell this story. There are other people who tried to head off Keynesianism. They weren't quite as early. The great thing about Hayek was the preemptive strike. He tried to get him before the general theory. But if you look at people like Popper and Schumpeter, they too had good reasons, and very interesting ones, for believing that Keynes was wrong in many respects. But it's Hayek who turns out to be the great saint of the right, the great hero of the right. And this implausible little man, here he is, literally buttoned up, serge suit, three buttons done up, round glasses, metal, like something out of Hollywood central casting of a European intellectual, or even a screen Nazi, actually. This little fellow, just by hammering away slowly, ended up being hugely important. Now, I've been criticized, and I quite acknowledge that criticism, it's a matter of storytelling, for putting Hayek on the same pedestal as Keynes. Of course, they were nowhere near similar in terms of intellect. Keynes is a fabulous man that if you were to study him for the rest of your life, you would never get to the bottom of him. He's extraordinary. He had 12 at least simultaneous careers. Fabulous man in every respect. Hayek was not. He was actually, I wouldn't say dislikable, but he was hard to like. And yet, he became so important that this November we will be facing a Keynes-Hayek election. Obama is promoting Keynes and wants more stimulus, and he's going to blame the Republicans. You are preventing us from making jobs because you won't pass the jobs bill, which is to do with creating jobs. And on the other side, whichever of that ragbag, that Snow White and Seven Dwarfs outfit that the Republican Party has become, they all mouth exactly the same thing. And that is that you should pay down the deficit now. This just sounds like Osborne, doesn't it? Pay down the deficit now. Reduce government fast. And then we can get back to fiscal continence and you know, a dreamy utopian future. There we are. That's my story. I found it fascinating to write and a dream to write. I was very glad when I'd sold the idea, when I looked back at Economica, that actually they were every bit as vituperative as I thought they were going to be. In fact, Pigou wrote a note warning the both of them. He said, this sort of thing must stop, you know. It's so sharp and so bitter, you must stop doing it. It's the language of the duello, he said. He said, and it was a very current thing in cricket, for those of you interested in cricket, he said, it's like bodyline bowling, he said. A remark I can't make in the United States, they don't get it. And he said, it's like fighting of Kilkenny cats. Well, all I can say is that that scrap has ignited an interest in economics more generally, which I must say that wherever I go to speak, I'm astonished by the numbers of people who are coming out. It's not to do with me, it's to do with the fact that Keynes is a great hero, Hayek is a great hero, and people, just like the original difference, the apostles, the disciples of both sides, are resuming the debate and the battle as took place exactly nearly 81 years ago. And so there you are. Thank you very much.